May it please the court. My name is Mark Simon. I'm the attorney for an injured worker named Carol Krauth in this workers' compensation case. We take the position that this case never should have proceeded to hearing in the first place, although it did proceed to hearing, and then we take the position that the workers' compensation claim was closed and should not have been reopened by the judge. Now, first looking at whether the case should have proceeded to hearing at all, we take the position that the claim was unright as a matter of law. At the time that the respondent filed its application for hearing and petition to reopen, the case hadn't yet been closed. So the way the procedures are at the Division of Workers' Comp, first there's a final admission that gets filed. If it's not objected to, it becomes final after 30 days. Then if there's a change in condition, fraud, or mistake, then either party can file a petition to reopen. This case is unusual because the application for hearing was filed 5 days before the final admission of liability. Now, I didn't raise the issue just as I would have wished I had at the very beginning of the hearing. At the very beginning of the administrative hearing before the administrative law judge, I did object to proceeding, but for a different reason. So I sort of had the right argument but the wrong reason. But I did correct that when I filed the brief in support of the petition to review, which is in the record at page 271, where I did raise the issue of whether or not the final admission of December 10th of 2008 foreclosed these issues from proceeding because the application for hearing actually preceded the final admission of liability. And the question was before Judge Jones, the administrative law judge in this case, when she issued her memorandum, which is in the record at page 291, where she writes, after review of the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, as well as any briefs that have been submitted, it is determined that a supplemental order is not necessary or appropriate. Please forward the file to the Industrial Claims Appeals Office for consideration. So I did get this issue about whether or not the matter should have proceeded to hearing before the ALJ in time for her to have corrected her findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, and she didn't do so. So the case has a very significant irregularity in it, in that it proceeded to hearing, even though it proceeded to hearing on reopening, even though it wasn't yet closed. The Industrial Claims Appeals Office addressed this at page 310 of the record, and they wrote, the claimant first argues that the December 10th, 2008 final admission of liability foreclosed the issues endorsed by the respondent in their application for hearing. We disagree, and then what follows is the discussion of Berg versus Industrial Claims Appeals Panel. So the Industrial Claims Appeals Panel didn't really reach the issue that I was raising. It's simply that it was procedurally irregular to go on with the hearing. Berg is about reopening a case when there was a change in an underlying medical diagnosis. So it doesn't really address the procedural issue which I raised. The respondent did address it in their reply brief, where they wrote,
excuse me, is that reply brief before the ALJ or before the ICAO?
It's the answer brief before the Court of Appeals.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, the one that they filed here. They wrote, thereafter, respondents became aware of the claimant's 2000 injury and prior impairment rating. On December 5th of 2008, respondents filed a petition to reopen the 2007 injury claim based on mistake and fraud. Although a final admission of liability was never formally filed until December 10th of 2008, respondents had acted in accordance with their October 22nd, 2008 final admission of liability and had represented that it had been filed, although it had not. Therefore, the respondents understood that reopening claimant's claim was the proper procedure in this matter. So respondent, even here in their brief, doesn't seem to be arguing that the proper procedure was followed. They're just explaining why they did what they did. So that's our first argument, that this never should have gone to hearing in the first place.
Well, counsel, let's pursue it. Let's assume for the sake of argument that this argument is available to us. I guess I fail to understand why we can't understand the FAL here, the petition to close, as implicitly reserving the issues that were presented in the prior filed motion to reopen. In other words, although unusual, why can't we understand it in that context? Why does it necessarily foreclose the presentation of these issues?
I don't think it does necessarily foreclose presentation of the issues, in all candor. I think that that is a procedural irregularity in the claim of such a great magnitude that the judge abused her discretion in proceeding to hearing. That's our position. But the application for hearing and the petition to reopen were already out there. So, of course, the claimant knew about that at the time that the final admission of liability was filed.
Okay, thank you.
The stronger argument is that the claim should not have been reopened at all.
Okay.
That's really the better argument. The reason that the claim is reopened is because after the closure of the claim or after the filing of the application for hearing, an insurance claims adjuster got some medical records indicating that 7 years prior to this compensable injury, the claimant had had an on-the-job injury for which he had had an impairment rating. And this happened after the final admission of liability had been filed. And so the respondent filed a petition to reopen based upon newly discovered evidence, basically. Well, at the Division of Workers' Comp, there's a procedure to get medical records in front of the division IME physician. In a certain period of time prior to the independent medical exam occurring, the respondent is required to submit the available medical records to the division IME doctor. If the claimant wants to submit additional records, they may do so. The IME doctor does the examination of the claimant, and he reviews those records, which are made available to him by the insurer and the claimant, and then he issues his opinion. And in this case, he did find that the claimant had a 7% impairment rating. And so the respondent never came forth at the hearing or even in their brief here with a reason as to why the records were submitted late or why the adjuster discovered that the records were in existence at such a late period of time. Judge Jones discusses at length in her order in paragraph 19 about how the claimant did a good job of notifying her treating doctors that she had a previous injury. Judge Jones wrote, the evidence established that claimant mentioned her 2000 work injury a number of times during the course of treatment for the 2007 injury. The evidence established that a number of her treaters were aware of the existence of the 2000 MRI of the lumbar spine, which was available for comparison and which treaters had compared. Finally, the evidence established that the 2000 and 2007 work injury occurred while this employer employed claimant, and that the information concerning the 2000 work injury would have been available to the respondents. So very important, Judge Jones found, as a matter of fact, that that information would have been available to the respondents.
That's in 19.
That's fighting fact 19? Yes, Judge. And then when the Industrial Claims Appeals Office visited the same question, they found that the claimant was not frank in her disclosures about her pre-existing medical condition, and that's really inconsistent with the opinion of Judge Jones. The ICAO wrote, here the ALJ in great detail reviewed the medical records from which a reasonable inference could be drawn that the claimant was not frank in her description of her past lumbar injury and workers' compensation claim. But that doesn't really seem to be consistent with what Judge Jones actually found. And the reason it's important is because it does matter whose fault it was that this mistake occurred. So our position is that, yeah, claims can be reopened on the basis of mistake, but only certain types of mistakes, and certainly not a party's negligent failure to provide an independent medical examining physician with medical records, and that is what happened here.
Is there any case law or even ICAO decisions that specifically hold that the employer would be barred from reopening by its own negligence and not diligently searching records?
There isn't anything that I have found, Your Honor.
Is there any language in the statute that leads to that conclusion, that there's a kind of an overarching negligence test here?
No, but if there wasn't, then any mistake would support reopening. So the examples which I would give you would be if a claimant forgot to submit mileage, request for mileage reimbursement to an insurer during dependency of a claim and the claim got closed, then later the claimant could say, well, I made a mistake, I wasn't diligent in submitting my mileage, I want the claim reopened. But the same thing could happen with prescription expenses. The problem with that is it makes it easy to reopen workers' compensation claims, and it undermines the finality of the final admission of liability, which there is a lot of case law on that, about the desirability of holding on to the finality of case law. Holding on to the finality of the final admission of liability. There is some case law that touches upon issues raised here, and I think the three main cases that I looked at anyway were the Cordova case. In the Cordova case, there's some dicta that says that just because the numerical impairment rating changes, that's not the type of change or the type of mistake which would support reopening. Now, the Berg case had to deal with that, and in the Berg case, reopening was permitted, but it was on the basis of a mistaken medical diagnosis, not the mistake of a numerical impairment rating. So yeah, there was reopening for a misdiagnosis, but not for a different impairment rating. And then the closest case I found on point was the Heineke case, which is cited in the brief, where a claimant received an impairment rating from a physician, a final admission was filed, and it became final, and then that very same physician changed the impairment rating. Well, the simple fact that the impairment rating itself had changed was not sufficient for a finding of a mistake or change in condition which would support reopening. So our basic position on this is that a party should not be allowed to reopen the case based on its own failure to exercise reasonable care in providing medical records to physicians. I don't believe that the issue has been specifically addressed before by the Court of Appeals. I would like to thank you for the privilege of appearing here today.
May it please the court. My name is Paul Kruger, representing the employer, attorney number 34592. Claimant raises a number of issues. I'll start with the procedural irregularity. I agree with opposing counsel that didn't prejudice the claimant. The mere fact that a petition to reopen and the application was filed technically before the final admission, they proceeded to hearing in March. The application and the FA were filed in December. There was no discernible prejudice to the claimant for proceeding on those issues. So I start off by saying that's somewhat of a red herring, and I appreciate opposing counsel indicating that that really didn't impact his defense in this case. Regarding the other issues, the Workers' Compensation Act clearly sets forth that you can reopen for an overpayment. It's in 843.303. It's one, you can reopen for that, and you have to do the usual standard mistake, something along those lines, and that's exactly what the respondents did here. What they did was, upon discovering that, lo and behold, there was another permanent impairment rating to the same body part 7 years prior, they filed a petition to reopen, and they went to the court and established that this was a mistake, that the physicians during the course of her treatment, and more specifically the dying physician, didn't have this information.
Let me cut you off there. I mean, it may be that Dr. Ramaswamy made a mistake because he didn't have the records from the prior injury. But how can your client claim to have been ignorant of the prior injury when it paid in excess of $20,000 to resolve that claim?
I don't know why that information wasn't brought forth earlier.
Under general principles of corporate notice, either your claims manager or your insurer paid the $20,000 in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that constitute at least constructive notice to the employer of the prior injury?
Even if it did, assuming that's true, Your Honor, and assuming that there is that notice, there's nothing in the Act or the Workers' Compensation Rules of Procedure that constitute a waiver if you fail to present that information to the dying.
Your petition to reopen, and I don't mean to offend you, but the petition to reopen could just say, sorry, I forgot, let's reopen, and that would be good enough?
If the ALJ, the administrative law judge, listens to the evidence and in her discretion determines that it was a true mistake.
But I think that begs the question in terms of whose mistake. Is it Dr. Ramaswamy's mistake, or is it your client's mistake?
The Act doesn't delineate what mistake it's supposed to be. It's
on what theory did you try the case to the ALJ, that the mistake was your client's in not giving Dr. Ramaswamy the prior records, or it was Dr. Ramaswamy's essentially a medical mistake because he drew the wrong conclusion?
Part of our theory was the fact that during the course of this, the claimant at times, maybe not deliberately or with a poor memory, misled various physicians with regards to the extent of the previous injury in 2000. Now, there are two parties involved here. I understand the employer would have notice, but clearly the injured worker was treated back in 2000 as well, and the injured worker received benefits as well. So the injured worker, from what the administrative law judge determined, at times wasn't entirely upfront with the various physicians regarding the extent of her previous injury.
Yeah, I'm not sure that exactly answers my question, though. And before the ALJ, did you try your case on the basis that you made a mistake in not researching this prior claim, or that, forgetting about that entirely, Dr. Ramaswamy simply made a mistake in attributing 7% PPD to the current injury?
This claim was litigated under the idea that the dying physician, for whatever reason, didn't have that information.
But it's a medical mistake.
Medical, yes, in so much as the claimant sustained a 7% in 2000, was given a 7% in 2007, the dying physician made a medical error by not apportioning the previous 7%. And that error was as a result of him not having that information from the 2000 injury. And what I think is important too, is the workers' compensation rules of procedure 11-3, I believe sub J, provide which party, and it's the respondents who provide the medical packet to the dying physician. That cost is incurred by the employers for the most part in these cases. There is nothing in that rule and nothing in the dying statute which says if a medical record is not included, employer is prohibited from in the future using that to overcome the dying. There's nothing in the rule regarding that. And in fact, 11-3 sub K, the following provision, provides that both parties can provide supplemental records to the dying physician. So this isn't a situation where one party is the only one who knows what records go. Both parties, by the time it got to the dime, knew what records were submitted to the dime, knew what records had the opportunity to submit supplemental records, and they didn't. So consequently, the dime physician was left with assigning a 7% permanent impairment rating and relating it to this injury, when in fact the administrative law judge determined, well, that was a mistake. If he had had this additional information, it would have been a zero.
Do you agree with your adversary's statement that there are no court decisions or ICAO decisions that address what, for lack of a better term, we're talking about the possibility of waiver being a bar to reopening?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And what's important, too, is when you look at the administrative law judge's decisions, the findings in this case, she did not affirmatively find. She did not make a determination that the respondents waived anything. She did not make a determination that by not doing this, they knowingly or willfully didn't do this. She did make the finding, and I agree with opposing counsel, that, yeah, they probably had this information, or it's likely that they did. But she did not make the finding that they knowingly and willfully failed to provide this to the dying physician.
Would knowingly and willfully be part of the determination under anything in the statute or the rule?
It would only be, Your Honor, if this court were to interpret the statute or the rule, specifically 11-3, as to have some sort of a waiver requirement. And I'm adamant in the position that it does not do that.
But the waiver could be based on simple negligence. It wouldn't have to be based knowingly and willfully.
I would argue that it's going to be a willful violation. If it's going to be a waiver, that generally waiver would be a knowing violation, a willful violation.
Did your adversary argue specifically to the ALJ what we're loosely calling waiver?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'd like to finish up just briefly with opposing counsel's argument that there wasn't sufficient evidence to overcome here. This may seem this may seem like a harsh result in some ways, but really it's not. The employer is responsible for paying workers' compensation benefits for which the injury is responsible. And in this particular case, there was a great deal of the past medical records reviewed by the administrative law judge. And she provided a very detailed report as to why the 2007 injury should be apportioned in relation to the 2000 injury. Both had a Table 53 rating under the AMA guides, which is for this.
My question, even more than the others, may reflect some ignorance of workers' comp. But no, it's not your fault.
Okay.
I mean, why wouldn't it make more sense to return this to Dr. Ramaswamy, let him look at all the medical records, and then redetermine the extent of PPD allocable to the second injury, if any? I mean, why should the ALJ essentially be making a medical judgment weighing two different and possibly conflicting sets of records?
Because apportionment in this case is a legal determination under 843.104. It shall, and that statute's been changed, effective July for claims on or after July 1st, 2008, but this is a pre-change where the Workers' Compensation Act specifically provided that permanent impairment to the same body part shall be apportioned. That's in the act. We don't ask our physicians to read the act. They make a medical determination, which here they did. Here's the body part, but then it's up to the administrative law judge to determine whether or not that should be apportioned.
So when earlier you characterized Dr. Ramaswamy's mistake as a medical mistake, really what you're talking about is the legal consequence of these medical observations.
It's hard to articulate sometimes, Your Honor, how, because just recently in the Colorado Supreme Court, the Ruff case, there was a great discussion on whether or not a dime physician is a quasi-judicial actor. I mean, it's a very much talked about situation. The mistake that was made here, I can only say, is ultimately it's a mixture of law and fact. And that sounds like a cop-out, and unfortunately, but it's a factual determination in so much as what the rating was, what information did he have, what was the medical opinion, but then the legal consequence is under the act, in that the consequence of the dying physician results in a reduction legally under the statute of her permanent partial disability benefits. And importantly, the mistake standard can be a mistake of law or fact under 843.303. That's been well established as well. So the type of mistake, and importantly, I think there's one thing to be clear. There was no discernible advantage for respondents not to provide this information as early as they could. Clearly, we wouldn't be here. We would not want to do this. This isn't a situation, and I don't think it was any sort of advantage to respondents for not providing this information as early as they could, which I think demonstrates the lack of willfulness in this case, because it's always to both parties' advantage to have all the information to the dying physician so as not to do this sort of thing. There was no discernible advantage to the employer for waiting.
Now there's a discernible disadvantage to the claimant because you did wait.
True enough, Your Honor, but we are, the General Assembly permits us to recover overpayments, and that's essentially what we have here, is she has received workers' compensation benefits to which she is otherwise not entitled, and the Act requires us to collect that. If there are any further questions?
Well, while we're here, I can go ahead and display my ignorance of the workers' compensation scheme. It seems to me I'm taken by your observation that in the Ruff case, the dispute there was whether the dime physician's determination was akin to a legal or a quasi-judicial determination. That is an interesting one to me, because it seems that if it's in the nature of some kind of adjudication, then perhaps your client should be subject to the standards that would govern reopening a claim for newly discovered evidence, and you would be foreclosed from raising something that could have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence. If, on the other hand, it's not, if it's merely in the nature of an expert opinion, then perhaps this sort of failure on the part of your client to get this information in front of the dying physician would not be a deal breaker, and the ALJ's determination really would be the first adjudication in that sense. Can you tell me how did the Ruff court come out on this? What is the state of the law on this characterization?
There I go, opening my mouth. Well, in that particular, in the Ruff case, it wasn't about the information to the dying physician. And I believe you were on the Benevicius court, which was a similar case. It was about whether or not, for purposes of bias, what is the standard for a dying physician. They ultimately didn't reach whether or not it's a quasi-judicial function because there wasn't a due process. And again, I didn't read Ruff prior to today, but there's not a due process right such that those standards would apply for a bias determination with a dying physician versus a trial court. So I understand, and I've often thought in purposes of how to argue reopening to a court, what is the standard? Because I have to admit, 9 times out of 10, it's the other side it's the claimants who are attempting to reopen, not the respondents. And I've researched, and there is no clear specific delineation for newly discovered evidence. It's a very wide open, and often the ICO comes down to, it's simply in the discretion of the administrative law judge as to whether or not they could want to justify it. And Berg versus ICAO is a perfect example. In that case, there was a dime. Later, the claimant did a petition to reopen, and respondents argued, well, you're just trying to get around the dime. See, my time is up, unless you want me to finish.
You wouldn't mind just finishing your sentence.
Sure. And then in Berg, the respondents argued, you can't do this. You're trying to get around the dime by reopening. And this court answered, no, the reopening statute permits this. The administrative law judge is the gatekeeper regarding, it's in her discretion as to whether or not they feel there's some sort of circumvention of the dime going on.
Helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I have brief rebuttal?
You have three and a half minutes left.
May I use it?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I do want to address this question about who made the mistake, because I've read through these materials over and over, and it's hard to tell sometimes. Judge Jones's finding of fact number 20 wrote, it is found based on evidence presented at hearing that the award of PPD by the respondent without the dime's consideration of the 2000 lumbar spine impairment rating was a mistake, and therefore the petition to reopen is granted. So that seems to indicate that it was the award of the PPD by the insurer who either knew of or should have known of the previous PPD award that was the mistake in question. And the judge doesn't seem to assign a medical mistake, but then she says it was the award of the PPD without the dying's consideration of the 2000 lumbar spine impairment rating that was the mistake. So there seem to be two mistakes there. One was the payment of the PPD, and then the other one was that the Division IME doctor was not provided with a report at all. So in our argument, we get back to the fact that this situation was created by a failure to exercise reasonable care by the respondent in providing records of which it should have known, according to Judge Jones, to the Division IME physician.
Well, let me put to you a question or a statement made by your adversary. Before the ALJ, did you specifically argue that the employer's negligence in not researching this claim and providing the appropriate records was an estoppel or some other bar to reopening?
I don't believe that I did.
How is that issue properly before us?
The issue was first brought up in the petition of review, which was before Judge Jones, before she certified the case to the Industrial Claims Appeals Office.
Okay, so and again, this may be an ignorant question. So in your petition for review, you expressly made what I've been calling the waiver argument.
Yes, Judge.
Thank you.
I did. In a perfect world, I would have made it during the hearing or even prior to the hearing.
But I didn't. I did it later in the brief in support of the petition to review.
Thank you.
Thank you, judges.
The case stands submitted. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. A written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are excused. That exhausts our afternoon docket. The bailiff may announce our recess.
Subject to call.
Always interesting work, especially for possessed lovely trial lawyers. I don't know if you do a lot of appellate work. This is my third time. Good for her.
Yeah. See you later.
See ya.
Thank you.